Okay, well, the first thing I need to mention, which was I told to be at lunchtime, is we're actually finishing at 5 o'clock this evening. The actual teaching will finish at 5 o'clock. So I think that's a little bit later than most people usually have, but I think it's 4:30 is usually the close. But we're finishing at 5 tonight. So that's actually quite good because it gives us a chance to open it up for a few questions just towards the end for anybody who's got anything to query or to question or want further elaboration on anything I've said so over the course of the day. So it does give us a little bit of extra time to do that. Okay, well, I want to speak a little bit more about this whole practice of metta, its place within the practice, its relationship to sati, its relationship to what we actually call mindfulness. And I want to weave it around a few quotes. One of which I've promised to you, I kind of held out a promissory note about reading you the Metta Sutta, which is the locus that we find in the early texts for this practice. It's a rather lovely text. I like it. It's kind of old-fashioned in many ways, in the way it's put, but I think it's a very beautiful text. In Sri Lanka, just like in the past, they don't do it now, obviously, because we live in such a multicultural society, then children gather together in the morning in a school assembly. They used to recite something like the Lord's Prayer and all this sort of thing, Christian stuff. In Sri Lankan schools, they recite the Metta Sutta every morning. So it's not a bad start to the day, I think. But let me just read this to you, then I want to kind of open it out and pull some of the strands that I've spoken about so far together. So hopefully it becomes a little bit more coherent. This is out of a very ancient text which I mentioned this morning called the Sutta Nipata. Sutta Nipata is reckoned even by most scholars to be the oldest part of the canon. The language is very archaic. It's very, very different from some of the language which is much later that we find in the canon. I mean, that's beside the point. But this is what this sutta says. It's not that long, so don't worry. You're not going to be bored, I hope. To reach the state of peace, one skilled in the good should be capable and upright, straightforward and easy to speak to, gentle and not proud, contented and easily supported, living lightly with few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed, and should not do the least thing that the wise would criticize. One should reflect, may all beings be happy and secure, may all beings be happy-minded. All beings, whether they be weak or strong, tall, large, medium, short, small or big, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy-minded. Let no one deceive another or despise anyone anywhere. Let no one through anger or hatred wish for others to suffer. As a mother would risk her life to protect her child, her only child, so for all beings one should guard one's boundless heart. With friendliness for the whole world should one cultivate this boundless heart. Above and below and all around, without obstruction, without hate and without ill will, standing or walking, sitting or lying down, whenever one is awake, may one stay with this recollection. This is called the best possible way of living in this world, here and now. One who is virtuous, who is endowed with insight, not grasping after wrong view, having overcome greed for sensual pleasures, that person will not come to lie in a womb again. The last bit, just to explain, is just kind of very traditional idea that somebody who practices in this way would not be reborn. However we interpret that, I'm not going to get into that today. That's a big one. But that's a very traditional way of looking at it. But as we can see from this particular text, there is a lot of overlap. If any of you know the Satipatthana Sutta, the sutta deals primarily with mindfulness. And I was talking about this yesterday, and I know some of you were with me yesterday. That there is this great overlap in some of the language that's being used, showing this closeness between what we're calling mindfulness, and the practice of this friendliness. Remember, friendliness, not loving kindness. I don't know how that sounds to you. Friendliness is something I can do. I don't know about you. I can do that. Loving kindness, I think, is really difficult. I can be friendly to an awful lot of people and perhaps even extend it in the way the Buddha suggested. I don't know if I can love everybody. So it's a very big difference. I think the Buddha is being very practical. He's actually saying what you can do in this world. How you can base your life, how you can base your movement in relationship to others. And it can be based on friendliness, even if you don't like the other person. Even if you don't like what they stand for, even if you don't like what they do. You don't necessarily have to love them, though. And I think that becomes a much more difficult thing to do. And I don't think the Buddha is asking us to do that at all. So again, it's very, very practical. I actually would say that one of the first steps, again, pulling together something I've already talked about today, one of the first possible steps that we can take towards this friendliness towards ourselves is to engage in practices which resource ourselves. Starting to do something which actually resources. Think, and it's quite good to do this actually, just even as a little exercise, what is it that depletes you? Just as a little exercise, kind of draw it up. Write down what you think depletes you in your life. Then have the other column that says what sustains you, what supports you, what helps you. If you find an imbalance between the two, you're running on a deficit. And that deficit can become that you're running on empty at some point. And I say that because that is it's a tragedy of the Western world, I think, particularly, that a lot of people end up running on empty. So you need something because there are so many demands being made on you. The Buddha is speaking 2,500 years ago in a very different culture, and he's saying this is the case even then. And in many ways, although it is a very, very different culture, in many ways, some things haven't changed. He lived in a time of political turmoil, of warring factions, the growth of economic centralized powers. He lived in an age of turmoil, basically. Does that sound familiar? We live in an age of turmoil as well. I don't think there's ever been an age that hasn't been an age of turmoil. That's why I was saying to the group yesterday, every culture, every time has always looked back and said, oh, that was a golden era then. And if you'd lived in that era, you'd have been looking back and saying there was a golden era before that. And people in Confucius's time were doing this, the time of the Buddha they were doing this. Thousands of years ago, people were looking back, thinking that there was a golden time. It's always been turmoil. There's always been conflict. In other words, there's always been the need for the sorts of things that the Buddha is very much speaking about. We live in an age which demands, as I say, so much from us. We live in an age which is becoming increasingly fast. I mean, perhaps that's something that is different from the Buddha's period, from the Buddha's time. Ancient India 2,500 years ago, despite all the turmoil and the conflict, wasn't that fast. In fact, even contemporary India sometimes isn't that fast. when you can still queue a whole day to get a ticket for something. So that kind of hasn't changed. But if you listen to this, this is a quotation, this is not from Buddhist material at all. But I think it gives the necessity for why something like mindfulness is really, really important in our era, in our age in particular. Speed, the demon of speed, is often associated with forgetting, with avoidance, slowness with memory and confronting. We move slowly when we want to listen to ourselves. We move slowly when we want to listen to others and to the world around us. We move slowly when we want to accept ourselves. The rush of contemporary life overwhelms us, and our ability, our simple ability to observe, to hear, and to step back and to wonder. Society wants to blow out the tiny, trembling flame of memory. And that's from a novelist, actually. I think somebody's actually just produced a new novel after about 13 years, somebody called Milan Kundera. Yeah. Unbearable Lightness of Being, some of you might know that novel. Yeah. This is actually from one of his more literary tracts about the art of the novel. But I think what he's saying is very prescient, very, very prescient. What we're doing, as you know, on a day like today, on any of these London Insight days, is slowing things down, isn't it? Mm. Actually beginning to actually take that step to kindly slow things down for yourself, so that you can do some of these things. Notice one of the things he says that we lose when we travel at speed, when we move at speed, the ability to wonder. Yeah. To wonder at sometimes some of the what we might consider almost the simple mundane aspects of life that passes by when we're moving with speed. We have no time to notice. As one poet back in, I think, the 18th, 19th century said, we have no time to stop and stare. We have no time to wonder any longer. And we lose something of our humanity in doing that. We have no ability to slow things down when we're caught up in this rush and flow of what the contemporary world demands of you. Now, what I'm not suggesting here is that we can somehow step outside of it. Is there a possibility of, in a sense, and this is a question as much as anything else, and you can only answer it in your own ways, is there a possibility of being able to live slowness within speed? Yeah. And I think that's really what we're talking about. To live in a way that is reflective, resourcing, and has kindness and perhaps what we're calling metta, this friendliness, at the heart of what we're doing. Because this is so, so important. I'm sure we all know this. Turmoil, conflict, speed. And speed adds to irritation. Speed adds to the kind of conflicts that we see. In contemporary life, I think it's always been thus. I think it's getting possibly worse. Yeah. I don't want to sound pessimistic, because I think there is actually something we can do about it, and something very, very practical we can do about this. And this is what Metta is devoted to, is doing this practical thing. It's what mindfulness in general is devoted to, in being able to live the lives that we lead with the demands that are made on us in such a way that it doesn't deplete us, doesn't make us angry and irritated constantly by what goes on in ordinary life. So that's the challenge, and these are some of the reflections in terms of, I wouldn't say answers, but responses that we can make, gestures that we can make, to coming into a friendlier relationship with our lives. Yeah. We can become very embittered, can't we? We can fall back and become very embittered about all the demands that are made on us and the things that people want of us, and particularly friends and family. And there's always something out there demanding something of you, isn't there? Always something out there demanding something of you. But instead of coming into that, into that sort of almost embittered position, there is something we can do, and these are the very practical things we can do to resource ourselves to stop us from falling into that position of embitterment, of being embittered within our lives, living lives which actually are grumpy. Yeah, there's one mood for you, grumpiness about a lot of things. And so metta becomes a foundation of this. And remember, I'm saying here, it's not two things. Metta is not one thing, and we're doing mindfulness over here, and we're doing metta over there. These are two things. In many ways, metta becomes a way of looking at life. Yeah? It's not an emotion, it becomes a way, if you like, of beginning to see things with a friendlier eye. Yeah. Doesn't come easily, because you've got to realize whatever age you are, you've spent a lot of time building up defensive habits. Habits that, in a sense, are self-protective, and we can understand why they've arisen, but don't allow us to really contact and to really see. And so sometimes, let's use a slightly ambiguous word, to be touched. Yeah? It's ambiguous, isn't it, that word? But in all its ambiguity, I think it has a great deal of meaning. To literally being touched by life. Sometimes we're touched in the wrong ways. This is to see whether we can be touched in ways which open us to responsiveness rather than reactiveness. Because all of those mental states that I spoke about, and I just referred to particularly as grumpiness and irritability and embitterment and things like this, are reactiveness. They are reactions, they're not responses to life. In one particular Tibetan tradition, for example, the whole notion of compassion, it doesn't really translate as compassion at all. You know, this particular word, the particular word they use in Tibetan really means a responsiveness. The ability to respond to life as it happens. Yeah. So, you've got to ask yourself the question here. Yeah. Do you want to keep on reacting, or do you want to be responding? Yeah. Reacting is easy. I don't know if you know that. It doesn't require any thought. It's usually so habitual and so easy. It's almost your default option. Yeah. What we're talking about requires effort, it requires energy. I spoke about some of these things yesterday again. You can't help but not touch on the same things from time to time, and this is a really important dimension. It requires energy, it requires effort. Energy and effort, within the Pali words which are used for this, also imply a courageous attitude. Yeah. The courage to go on in the face often of difficulty. The Buddha does not say this is easy. Yeah, let's make that really clear. I'm sure you possibly realise that, but I just want to emphasise. He does not say it's easy, but it is doable. Yeah. That's really, I think, what you need to hear. It's not easy simply because the tide is going in the opposite direction. Yeah. In fact, the Buddha says, my path is like swimming against the tide. The tide is going one way, this is going in another direction. Metta becomes the foundation. It becomes actually, literally, the soil out of which other wholesome mental attitudes arise. And I could equally say the same for what we call sati or mindfulness. It is a wholesome mental state out of which other wholesome mental states arise in conjunction with support and will develop other wholesome mental states as well. I'm very touched sometimes by what I see in just the ordinary practical mindfulness world. Nothing about, you know, kind of the research and all the stuff that you see lauded around, but just the way often these practices touch people and change their lives and make them examine their lives. And they're so simple, aren't they? They're so simple. What we're being asked to do sometimes is just starting to pay attention to see what's going on and not to hook into all of those reactive patterns. Yeah. And sometimes you do it and sometimes you don't. Yeah. And as I say, there's no failure in that. That's just the way it is. Sometimes you can do it and you find yourself unhooking, a bit like, you know, unhooking a I don't know, the truck from the train. Yeah. And other times you just get carried along. And then you suddenly realise you've been carried along, and then you unhook. So it doesn't matter whether it's further down the line or closer. There's always that possibility of being able to unhook and in a sense, move out of those compulsive states. To move out of those compulsive states. And metta is one of those that allows us to unhook. What's this allowing us to unhook from here? Yeah, it's kind of a rhetorical question. I'm going to answer it. Which is, it allows us to unhook from aversion, doesn't it? Yeah. Aversion is a pretty good mental state. I'm sure we're all fairly familiar with it. Yeah. Aversion. Dislike. What we don't want. Yeah. I was struck by, you know, even in something like Freud, the pleasure principle has nothing to do with pleasure. It's about what you don't want. Yeah. So you get all of this stuff that we can recognise. And again, this is quite a good practice, isn't it? Sometimes just to recognise all the things that you say, I don't like that, don't want that, don't I like that. That's really something I don't want in my life. You know, this kind of all is pushing away. Yeah. Metta is actually implying for us to draw close to. Again, this is having resonances with mindfulness, with sati, with drawing close and standing close to something, even if it's something you don't like, even if it's something you don't want, yeah, to stand close to it and to not be in a reactive state with it. And if you are in a reactive state, to have that ability to observe that reactive state. Yeah. It's a very simple reflection. I don't know if it's ever occurred to you, but all of our reactive states are, A, they're unstable, they're passing through. Like all mental states, they are not permanent. Isn't that a good thing? I always delight in the idea of, you know, in Buddhism they call anicca, which is actually change, impermanence. Yeah. Impermanence is a good thing. Yeah, I would not want to be stuck with some of the mental states I can have at certain times, and I'm sure you wouldn't either want to be stuck with some of the mental states that you have. Because they're changing, yeah, they move away. But even when it's the most, it's the most negative state you could possibly be in. Even if it's a really, say, let's take an example, just a state of anxiety or anger or something. When we take this movement, which I'm saying is a kind of metta sati movement, mindfulness, friendliness movement. And step back into a position of an observer in that movement, then whatever the state we're observing, whether it is that supreme anger, whether it's that, you know, intense irritation or hyper anxiety, that which is doing that observing isn't angry, it isn't irritated, and it's not in any of these mental states to which you see. So that simple movement in a way often described as taking like a step backwards away from it is what we're calling the unhooking. We're using different metaphors here to really describe the same process. The unhooking from those mental states. The paradox is that in friendliness, in the unhooking of friendliness, we're unhooking from the aversion, which is the reactive state, which gets caught into it, pulled along into further states of aversion. Have you noticed how everything, when you're really grumpy, appears yuck? Yeah, doesn't it? There's hardly anything that you can look at or see which doesn't appear to support that feeling at that point in time. So you're kind of being pulled into it. Everything is confirmatory of that feeling. And very little speaks against it. So we are resisting that movement of being pulled in, but we're doing it in a way which bespeaks of friendliness as opposed to simply aversion to the aversion. I mean, that's a crazy position to be in, isn't it? You know, I'm averse to the aversion. Yeah, I don't like it, don't want it. Yeah. It's what I call aversion or dislike with compound interest. Yeah, we just get sucked into this aversion to the aversion. Yeah. It's being anxious about the anxiety. We're just compounding the problem. So we're moving into a position which isn't being sucked into that, but also is beginning to look, to train ourselves, and this is a key word, train ourselves, to start to see it with a friendlier, less critical eye. The one thing about I think the one thing we can often say about a lot of mental states, I wouldn't say all, but a lot of mental states, is actually they're completely justified. If you want to have a rationale about it, and I'm sure we've all done this for ourselves, when we felt really grumpy about something, you go through these wonderful rational justifications about why you're grumpy. Yeah. The most compelling rational reasons. The logic almost can't be faulted as to why you're feeling grumpy at that moment in time. So it's not rationality that's going to break that down. Yeah. Because you've got almost a watertight case. So the only thing that's going to break it down is, in a sense, a different way of knowing those situations. And that's not going to arise easily. It's only going to arise, in a sense, by a training. The actual term in Pali is viraga, which is actually means something, a more dispassionate training. A beginning to see things from a position of not being sucked into them. Not just simply being pulled, as I've indicated in using lots of different metaphors, being pulled into those situations. Yeah. But also, notice, not ignoring them. Now, you have heard, those who come frequently to these days will have heard teachers, I'm sure, again and again and again, saying, not pushing away, but not getting caught up with. Yeah. Notice how that's a middle balance. It's actually part of your training in equanimity, too. Yeah. Equanimity is to be engaged with, but not pulled by aversion, or being sucked in also by that attraction, that compulsion as well. Now, again, it sounds like a big word, and it's actually a word that's not used that much in English, is it? Equanimity. I think that says a lot. The fact we don't even use the word a lot in English is there's not a lot of it around. Yeah. So equanimity doesn't start with this kind of big idealized aspect of it. The equanimity is to be in that position of not being sucked in, but also not pushing away. Yeah. This is part of it. In a sense, when we speak about this, these four aspects, which again I'm sure people have spoken here many times about, which is generally known as the Brahma-Viharas. Brahma-Viharas is a metaphor that Buddha is using. It's a metaphor that's lost in our culture because it doesn't actually mean that much to us. So it gets translated as things like divine abidings and all sorts of strange translations. But then it's actually a metaphor for liberation, from liberating ourselves from compulsive states. Yeah. In ancient Indian society, if you said to somebody, look, the word Brahma-Vihara, or the phrase Brahma-Vihara, literally means to dwell with Brahma. A Vihara is a dwelling place. Yeah. Actually, it's actually the proper word for what we call monasteries in Buddhism, is a Vihara. Mm-hmm. It's literally just a dwelling place. That's all it is. Yeah. So when we speak about dwelling with Brahma, if you spoke to somebody in ancient Indian society, particularly from ancient Indian, what we would now call Hindu society, and you said you were going to dwell with Brahma, it would be taken as a synonym for liberation. They would be somehow liberated in some way. It would be like reaching the goal of what they were practicing. Now the Buddha is saying, not through all of these austerity practices, through all the kind of yogic practices that were there in ancient India, that one could achieve this goal. He's saying one can achieve this goal going to dwell with Brahma, using that as a metaphor, be liberated by the practice of metta, friendliness, karuna, outgoing kindness, through mudita, which is generally translated as empathetic joy, but actually means a gentle joyfulness. Literally, the Pali means a gentle joyfulness. And finally, one I've already mentioned, upekkha, equanimity. Mm-hmm. He's saying, if you really want to be liberated, these are the ways to do it. Manifest these in your life. And the Metta Sutta makes that very clear. Metta Sutta is talking all the time, even that very, very, very brief sutta, very brief discourse, about liberation. Saying one who practices this practice in this way will gain liberation. Hence the metaphor at the end about not being reborn again. Yeah. And it is a metaphor within these early texts. So the Buddha is offering a path, and I hope you see this, and if you've been involved sometimes with certain traditions, you get the whole idea that basically the edifice of Buddhism can be very intellectual. Yeah. The best way of getting liberation is to think your way to it. Mm-hmm. It's not that case. The Buddha is speaking about something intensely practical. Intensely practical. And the practicality starts with you. It starts with how you relate to yourself. And by extension, how you relate to yourself often determines how you relate to others. So if I show unkindness, if I show forgetfulness, let's go back to the Kundera quote. And interesting, one of the real meanings of the term mindfulness in this Pali form sati, is remembrance, recollection. You know? The opposite of being mindful is actually asati, which means being forgetful. Yeah. We can live in a state of forgetfulness. And actually we're being encouraged to do that a lot of the time. Yeah. A lot of contemporary life encourages forgetfulness. Forgetfulness of being. Offers out all the goodies and says, you know, you can have these as a substitute for being. Mm. Yeah. This is effectively what, you know, a lot happens in Western society in that way. And as a consequence of that, we often forget who and what we are and what we're doing and our relations, and often things which are really important to us. Really important things like sensual experience. I'm not saying sensory craving, but sensual experience, embodied experience. We forget to treat ourselves with any kindness because we're striving to be happy. Isn't that a paradox in terms? I'm striving to be happy. I read a quote yesterday, I won't read it today, but I read a quote yesterday by Pascal, the French philosopher and mathematician, and he's saying, you know, we're always planning to be happy, and as a consequence of that, we never are. Yeah. This is what we're always doing. We're always looking out ahead, trying to make ourselves happy. Often giving yourselves, and again, reflect on it for yourselves about how you do this for yourself. Yeah? Because it's not just simply an abstract idea. You know, this is what we're often doing. Sometimes in very conscious ways, sometimes in much more unconscious ways. We're giving ourselves little goals which we say, if I get that, I'm going to somehow be happy and satisfied. Yeah. My suggestion is actually, even if you get it, you won't be. Yeah. It possibly increases the dissatisfaction. Yeah. So we're being encouraged to be forgetful. We're being encouraged to forget often fundamentals of the things which I've spoken about, which can resource us, and we're often forgetting the fundamentals of what it means to simply be here in this world, not with all the things. Yeah, and all the stuff and all the pleasures that can come from some of that stuff. And I'm not denying that, and I'm not saying, you know, isn't good fun to have some of it. I'm really not saying that, but it's no substitute for being. It's no substitute for being. It's no substitute for the human qualities of engagement, of kindness and friendliness. Yeah. It's no substitute for the compassion and the engagement of that with others. No substitute for appreciation, which is actually what the real meaning of this gentle joyfulness is appreciation. The joy comes out of being appreciative. Appreciative, for example, might, as I suggested, just looking out the window and seeing the green. You know, seeing the leaves being waved in the breeze. You know, these little things that we often are forgetful of, aren't we? And go, I'm really miserable. Everything is so boring. I feel burdened by my thing. And then, of course, what we're doing in that, we kind of collapse into ourselves. We collapse into ourselves. To really move in the way that the Buddha's suggesting is to move outwards. Part of the decreasing, and I haven't got time to go into this today because I'm aware that the time is getting on, it soon zips away on a day like today. But part of what the Buddha is suggesting is to start moving outwards, and in that outwards movement, we start to decrease the dominance and the tyranny of the ego. The dominance and the tyranny, not just of the ordinary, practical, everyday self that needs to be there for us to function as coherent individuals, but that self-obsessive, neurotic ego, you know, that we can take so seriously. You know, and everything that ego says has got to be listened to. You know, and we take it so seriously. Iris Murdoch had a wonderful phrase. She called it the great big fat, restless ego that sat obscuring your vision. And occasionally what you do, and so I think it's very graphic, isn't it? It's a great fat, restless ego sitting in front of you. And what you do occasionally is go round the corner, just peer around the corner of it, you know, and perhaps get a glimpse of something else. But we're literally enraptured and captured by that a lot of the time. Now these movements, starting with oneself, is a reorientation. You know, this could be a very long talk, but it's not going to be. Because the movement starts in the self, in a sense, with becoming and heightening our awareness of this moment and what this moment contains for its good, its bad and its indifferent, whatever it is, starting to do that. But then suggesting, as I've suggested all the way through today so far, is that it's not just a question of seeing something. And all too often, of course, meditation gets associated with just seeing it as somehow as if that's going to change it. It's not. You know, if I sit here, I could sit here for years, you know. I sit here for years kind of eyeballing what's going on. And now I have a greater understanding of the mess. That's all. That's not the Buddha's suggestion. He's not saying just by having an awareness of the mess, it's going to somehow change it. And the awareness of the mess is because then we can start to form and reform different relations with it and move away from reactivity into sometimes doing things and sometimes just reorienting the way that we look and relate to those things. Now the most fundamental way, and this is, I know it's been a long way of coming around to this, the most fundamental way, of course, is metta karuna. These again are not two separate things. It's not first we will practice friendliness or loving kindness, if you still like the old translation, and then we'll get on to compassion. And we'll do that later. Yeah. It's a tick list, isn't it? Yeah. done my metta, now I'm into my compassion. It'd be interesting to see how you're going to get down to the equanimity bit, but never mind. So it's not a tick list. These two come together. They're actually fundamentally of the same form. I mean, so much so, there's a lovely quotation by a Tibetan thinker, a 14th century Tibetan called Longchenpa. Longchenpa says, out of the soil of metta, out of the soil of friendliness, grows the beautiful bloom of compassion. Watered by tears of joy, in the cool shade of the tree of equanimity. It shows the interdynamic relationship between all of those factors. It is not as if you're developing them in a linear fashion. The soil is necessary, and the cultivation of that soil is necessary. And that's what we're starting to engage in doing, in starting to reorientate ourselves, even if it's just simply through mindfulness practices. Practice with a non-critical eye, but even if there isn't a non-critical eye, because that's not easy to do, is it? You know, that's a habit of a lifetime for many of us, coming to that, having that critical eye. In fact, we were kind of taught from children often to be very self-critical. Yourself, you know, and it's become a real habit, a dominant habit. That to then take a step back, even from that, is to move into a position which isn't critical. We see, in other words, even that critical thought as just another thought. And thoughts all should come with a little label, and the label is just passing through. That's what the label says. Because that's actually what happens. They might return again, yeah, but that one has the label just passing through again. Yeah. We somehow inhibit this process. So these very simple practices allow us to reorient ourselves, to move into a different relationship with our thought processes. But it's not all about me, because it then enables us to move into a much more wholesome relationship with others around us in the world. Based, though, to a degree, and it's not, I have to do this first and then I move out. It occurs together. But when one is doing this and developing the sense of kindness and reorienting our ways of looking at our mental processes. For example, if you really begin to palpate, to understand, I'm really using that word physical, isn't it? Palpate, touch, really almost massage what's going on. If you really begin to see that and you begin to understand the depth of your perverseness, how perverse you can be. The human mind is wonderfully perverse. Then it perhaps can make you a little bit more forgiving of the perversity of others around you. If you really understand that within yourself, how we constantly undermine even our own best intentions. I don't think any of us go out in the morning saying, this is a wonderful day to be nasty. I think I'll go out and be really horrible to the first person I see. But stuff happens, doesn't it? As you move through your day. And then you find yourself in that position of being irritable or angry or grumpy about something, and it comes out in a particular way. And actually, you see that happening with others as well, when they are unpleasant to you as well. I often say, it's not always true, but I often say sometimes when people are grumpy and angry and irritable with you, it's nothing personal. Feels like it though, doesn't it? A lot of it isn't very personal at all. It's really, you are just the object that happens to be there, and so you get it. Out of the frustration of living, the frustration of just daily life. Now, the reason I'm saying all of this is for that very simple reason. If we start to understand how some of this operates, if we start to see it with an eye which is much more friendly in its orientation, less reactive, then of course that influences our behaviours with others. I'm not saying always, because this starts in small ways. I see this with, you know, just ordinary people doing mindfulness in a non-Buddhist context sometimes. You know, they start to become less reactive. And suddenly say, I've surprised myself. I don't any longer quite do what I used to do. And I don't always get angry in that situation like I used to. And they surprise themselves, actually, that these things have changed. And this is what we're doing, much more so, even much more so, I would say, even in a Buddhist context, in the context of a kind of insight meditation pathway. We're doing this, and often we can be surprised at the change. But the changes are not always big. They're sometimes very small and they're very incremental. And they are like little mini liberations. Having become liberated from compulsive, habitual reactiveness. As again, I was saying to the group yesterday, just think how that feels, those moments, when you've liberated yourself from that, from a habit, but even particularly from, particularly from a mental habit of reactiveness. It has a taste, and the taste generally is feeling a little freer in that moment. And okay, you might fall back in it, but the remembrance of that taste of freedom might make say, you know, perhaps there was something going on there that, you know, I could have done differently. Will make you re-examine your relationship. So, this is a very big story. I'm giving you a very, you know, it's a very big story, and I'm giving you a very short snapshot of it here. Is that these practices are about caring for self and caring for others, where I started this morning in that quotation. In learning to care for ourselves in these ways, we learn to care for others. In learning to care for others, as the Buddha says, we learn to care for ourselves in this way. I'm emphasizing the work that often goes on in relationship to seeing friendliness to our own foibles, our own problems, our own ways of being, because all too often that gets underestimated, certainly in the societies in which we live at present. Things get underestimated, and it really needs to have a corrective to this, that it's not you before others or others before you. It's together equally. Together equally. That's how the development really takes place. So there's a slight readjustment in having to bring us back to a little of the importance of holding yourself with kindness, holding yourself with some compassion. And I could say a lot more about that, but unfortunately I haven't got time to do it. And in doing so, then it starts to reorient and change our relationships with our world, with the others who are not just there to irritate you. Others are there trying and struggling to live their own lives as well, often with all the kinds of stuff that's going on for us, sometimes even more so. And I think that's important to remember. So it's a common base of humanity. And we can have a common base of humanity which is developing through that friendliness and that compassion, extending to ourselves, which becomes by extension to others. Or we can remain in our isolated sense of aloneness, in our speed, in our forgetfulness, and in the destructive emotional states that we can inhabit as a result of that. I personally don't think, and perhaps this is a good place to finish, I personally don't think actually there's a choice in this. Not a real choice. If you're thinking about choosing, it just seems to me the most sensible option is to move towards some way of resourcing yourself. Because otherwise you are simply in those other states. Those other states, I hesitate to say it, but almost come naturally, don't they? In fact, they feel natural. And that's what's so compelling about them. They feel natural. And when something feels natural, to do something with a corrective to it feels unnatural. And that's what we're being asked to do. It can feel unnatural, it can feel odd. to do, for example, the practice that we've done this morning, just extending those phrases towards yourself, but not trying to generate any particular emotion out of it. Remember, that's what I was saying this morning. We're just getting back into the practice now. Not trying to generate any particular emotion, but using those phrases, extending them towards yourself, and literally saying, I'll see what happens. Yeah. Might be something, might be nothing. Might be physical, might be mental. Yeah. But what is happening when I do that? So this is just a piece of training, and that is all. It's an experiment. And that's how I always think of meditation, as a little experiment that you engage in. I'll sit here and see what happens. And that's a good place to stop. Because we're now going to have a practice. You've been sitting for a while. You might like to stand for a couple of minutes.